The Six Nations on Off the Ball with Vodafone. Official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. We all belong to the team of us.
All right, a very good afternoon to you. Welcome along to our rugby special here with Brian O'Driscoll this evening. Wherever you are, thanks for joining us, and well done to you. And thanks to you for joining us as well. You had a big night last night.
It wasn't a bit. You know, this is becoming a recurring theme here. Thursday's my night out.
I was in a supporting role with my wife last night at the IFTAs. So, yeah, it was for a school night. It was late.
Yeah. Give us some gossip from the IFTAs. Is it good?
Yeah, it was good fun. Deirdre O'Kane was brilliant. She was hosting it. Very funny. Also, Irish crowds are difficult crowds. We're not going to laugh unless there's some funny jokes.
Yeah. And
it
also,
has to be proper, genuinely funny.
There's a lot of drinking and talking.
And as well, there wasn't that much drink had. We came in quite late, but so there wasn't that much had. So it wasn't as though there was a giddy crowd, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
So she did brilliantly, I have to say.
Did they
really,
rattle through
really
quickly
good.
Enough?
Yeah, it was
complaints
good.
In previous years, weren't there? People were expected to sit through for hours. They weren't getting their dinner.
About an hour and a half, I think. They got it. Maybe an hour and three quarters. They got it all done. There's a lot of awards, so...
Yeah.
Some presenters were doing two and three awards, which is the way to go. And obviously, then there were big, you know, Lifetime Achievement Award for Gabriel Byrne.
Yeah.
And
did he speak?
Yeah, he did. Pretty eloquent.
Yeah.
He's cool.
Yeah.
He's really cool. So, yeah, it was a very fun event, I have to say.
Great. Did you
Craig?
Win?
Hmm?
Did you win?
No wins. A nomination, but Katrina Balf won in Amy Huberman's category.
All right.
So
stern competition.
Yeah, it was a couple of reasonly good actresses in that group. Ruth Negga thrown in the mix as well.
Okay.
So yeah, she was up against it, but I think she did say that Katrina Balf was lovely in the toilet, so it makes losing a little bit easier, doesn't it?
Right, let's move on because we've got to talk about some rugby. We haven't talked to you since Ireland slayed the Italians, and like the concession of the three tries has become the main narrative from this, because what the hell else do you talk about in a game that's over 26, 27 minutes in when we've already scored our four tries?
Yeah, you look, I went through the game again and you look at 21 minutes, we scored 21 points. Mm. So when you serve that up that early in a game, you know, expectation for the next 60 remains as high, and then when you don't achieve it, it's a disappointment.
Yeah.
Which is unrealistic too, because 56 points against any team in the Six Nations is a good outing.
Yeah.
Yes, they did concede three tries, and I do think that wide defence is continuing to be Ireland's Achilles heel. They are getting caught on the extremity, and if teams are going to look at going after Ireland, it's about trying to get them out there. England is probably their weakness, but they never let the ball out there. Whereas we, with our line speed, I don't think it's as aggressive as England. So, you know, good passing sides have the opportunity to get into those spaces. And there's one or two times that I saw like the front row defending together as a unit.
Yeah, you could see
chase.
Somebody had a look at it and went, ooh, you know, it's two front rowers.
Yeah,
I'm
it was like,
you.
No, actually, it was Porter, Jack McGrath, and Rory Best following a kick chase. And that's a dream for a fullback. So that organisation, there's still a little bit of work to be done on that. I do think as well with, besides the defensive aspect, when you make those wholesale changes, and people talk about the disruptiveness of new players coming in and trying to keep that continuity going, not only is it new combinations coming in, these guys will have had so little time throughout the week in the team. So the bench players get hardly any time. You have to really fight to swap in and out.
Explain that, will you? What do you mean during the week?
The starting 15, you know, no starting 10 or centre wants to be letting, you know, the bench swapping in for reps, because they want to do it themselves. They're the one that they're beginning the game.
Yeah.
They're going to be playing the most of it. So they're going to want the lion's share of pitch time within the team. So as a bench player, you know, you do have to, if you don't say anything, you could find yourself with very little time in the team, plugged into getting your timing off, you know, be it scrum half, off deliveries, you know, off those set plays that they, you know, those power plays where they're building three phases, all that small detail. Yes, you can do it in your head, and Joe's big on the mind gym, thinking about it an awful lot when you're off your feet and looking at analysis, but there's nothing quite like going through it at training. So
hang on, the guy who shouts loudest in terms of the reserves is the guy who's going to get the more reps.
And then you have to be careful too.
So
because
if you're
Andrew
Porter, who's only been in the place a wet week, you're probably keeping yourself to yourself.
Or Jordan Larmour.
Yeah.
No, it's his
like
first.
That,
yeah.
That shouldn't be on his shoulders. Surely Joe Schmidt is cognizant
I'm not privy to what Joe. I'm sure Joe, you know, introduced him here and there. But my experience was that you had to try and encourage some coaches would stand back and just let it.
You weren't going to come out and say, "Oh, here, come on."
I was like, yeah, you have a go. Yeah, have a go in there and see how good you can be at training. You don't want to do that either, you know. Show the coach how brilliant your competition is, within the team environment.
In the team, though.
I know. I think certain players are more comfortable than others, but I wouldn't be in a rush to be, handing over my training time too.
Yeah.
What does that mean? It means more chance for them to improve and also less for me.
Yeah.
So until the coach says, swap in there, I want to see different combinations tried out, or Keith Earls, you move into the centre there. You're not going to do it.
And the training sessions aren't like 10 hours a day. There's like short 40-minute sessions once a day for 3 days of the week in the build-up to the game.
That's it. And then
you're going to get the chance to do it.
And like you might get in for a captain's run. You might get in for two plays. That's not even full bore, you know? It's, you're running around and And then there's also, for someone like Jordan Larmour, there's a nervousness to actually being in the first team, even at training.
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh God, I'm on the bench, but this is my opportunity. So when all that freshness comes, I suppose it's. I would think it's probably quite mentally fatiguing as well to try and take all that information on board.
So Larmour obviously is somebody who needs a bit more of that, but Joey Carby definitely needs more.
Definitely, yeah.
He's not playing tonight for Leinster and isn't really being given the opportunity. So he comes off the bench and there's a slightly loose kick and they score a try off it. And you're thinking, well, like, maybe if he'd played a little bit more, if he'd just been given a little bit more of an opportunity, that kick is 10 yards shorter or has a bit of a better hang time. So that's a very difficult thing for him to be stepping into.
He's in a really tough spot because of Ross Byrne as well, because Ross Byrne has gone well for Leinster this year when he's been asked to, because Joey's been injured at times, doesn't get any of the game time because of Jonathan Sexton in the big European game. So he's really caught between two stools at the moment of not getting any love. Half an hour at the weekend, fine. He needed that. The game was won, an opportunity to give him some longer game time. But ultimately, I don't know what his minutes are like for the year, but they're very, very low comparatively to everyone else.
Well, he played 22 minutes since October before he came off the bench last Saturday.
Well, there you go.
So he's in a really bad place.
I don't care. I don't care how talented you are, or how fit you are on the training park, or how much work you've done with physios or strength and conditioning, to get yourself in primed for game mode.
Yeah,
like Sexton goes down a minute into the Welsh game.
It is so difficult.
He's the guy that has to run the game for us.
That is hard.
It is bloody impossible. Hard at the moment. Yeah, it is hard.
And so,
and I really feel for him because he's. But what do you do too? Do you rest? Joe Schmidt asking Leo Cullen, will you rest Jonathan Sexton for a few of your European games or some of the bigger inter-provincial games? No.
Well, I guess, so there's a clash coming because Leinster don't really see him as a 10. They see him more as a fullback.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting just seeing what Joe was asked, does he see him as a possible 12? And they said that he tried him out a little bit at training. If one of the centres had gone down, there's an option of moving him in there at 12 because he's a good defender. He's a gutsy defender. I wouldn't say he's ever going to smash people like Bundy and Robbie do, but he's a proficient tackler. But then what you do get from him at 12 is the distribution, crazy footwork, and a nice balance with him and a Bundy and a Robbie. So I'm starting to grow to the idea of seeing him potentially in a 12 role, because again, it's about, and you talk to a lot of the coaches, they all speak very highly of Joey. He's obviously trains very well, and he has the ability to make people look silly on the training park. So it's just about
the spill of the hips.
His feet
are pace. Like, it's not burning pace. Is
not burning pace, but his short. Feet are wicked. It's back 3 feet, and winger footwork,
right.
And in close proximity. That's why he doesn't ever get absolutely annihilated. Sometimes, he looks as though he's kind of loping at 10 and looks as though there's nothing on. You're going, he is going to get monstered here, and he never does.
Yeah.
Because he can wriggle himself out to get to a semi-soft shoulder and just avoid that huge impact. Not that many players can do that. Ross Byrne can't do that. Johnny can't do that, because he has a different level of agility.
Yeah. So you look at the way Owen Farrell is running games from 12, and I realise it's completely ridiculous to suggest that maybe Johnny Sexton might have a period of his career where he plays out of 10 and plays, and he moves to 12.
He could do that too, no problem. Everyone forgets that he did a good bit of it in 2011 in the World Cup when we weren't sure. Yeah, we weren't sure who was going to start, Roger or Johnny, and Gordon went off a couple of times in that World Cup, and Johnny went into 12, and it's
a far more obvious fit, isn't
so
it?
Comfortable. I remember being incredibly comfortable because I know that Johnny's a really good defender. He's not someone that takes the easy option as well, and that's what you want from your 12.
Yeah.
You want someone that's going to work hard for you to make your job a little bit easier. So Johnny's not someone that kind of tags someone and goes, "Oh, I got my man. Yeah. You know, I'm all right, Jack." He's not that sort of player, as Gordon certainly wasn't. So I just think that Johnny at the moment, he's still at the height of his powers.
Sure.
He still is able to influence games much better at 10 than he would be at 12. You talk about Owen Farrell, I think George Ford is really humming as a result of Farrell and the pressure that he's taking off him. And I think Farrell's making Ford look like a phenomenal player at the moment. Even though I think for me the jury's still fractionally out on Ford. I think I'd love to see Farrell out of that team and how well Ford would conduct things on his own now with a Ben Teo in there.
Yeah, we've seen a bit of that.
And having to kick as well. He doesn't have to worry about the place kicking. He doesn't have to worry about the line kicking.
Yeah.
Like he can just use it. He knows he's a good distributor of the ball, and that's all he's in the team for.
So that is, George Ford is one of the best passers in the world. There's no doubt that there is an understanding between the two of them. I don't know whether it's that leaguey influence, and they obviously grew up close to one another back in the day. Did they play on? I have a feeling they might have played on certain teams together. But that try that Ford scored against Italy, where Farrell ran that insane line out to in line, it was a brilliant line that Farrell picked, but also the quality of the pass to realise Farrell was running that line, and he hit him so hard on the advantage line and then followed it up himself for the return play to get a score. Like, that was a thing of beauty.
There's no way that they go ahead and just do that for a game as big as the Wales game, is there, where like Sexton starts at 10 and Carberry starts at 12, given, because we're effectively talking about the replacement for Henshaw here. This conversation is all about how do you actually manage this, and the fact that they didn't put Carberry back in for the Leinster game to give him game time, it's a bit odd. You're just protecting a sub if he's just going to be a sub, and that's fair enough, maybe that's what you want to do, but like, so
if you've got a fit Gary Ringrose, who's only played marginally fewer minutes than Joey Carberry, surely if that's the road you're going down, putting somebody in that's got very little game time under the belt, surely you pick the actual centre.
I do think when you're playing with a full deck of everyone there, I think the centre pairings are Gary Ringrose plus one. I think you've got to have a bit more creativity at 13. I think we're just lacking that slightly. The two boys at the weekend, the last two games, Henshaw and Bundy, have been a good partnership. Absolutely, they've both had strong games in both outings. But I just like having a little bit more creativity that Ringrose provides at 13. I think he can split defences with his vision and with that little bit of footwork. His lines of running are a little bit more impressive than both Bundy and Henshaw. So for me, I think it's Gary plus one. And at the moment, Bundy's been very good, but I think Gary's Robbie's defence when he's fit again, his defence, his work rate and everything that goes around, he doesn't make that many mistakes. I think that's a really nice combination.
We started the Six Nations with almost everybody fit, with the exception of Ringrose and then Sean O'Brien, and then obviously Heaslip was gone too. But now you get a little way through it and you realise you do need all that depth. So maybe it's time to try something like putting Carberry out, or maybe, you know, Carberry gets into 10 and gets a bit of experience at 10, like in and out as the game progresses, you know.
Okay, it's Wales,
I think Scotland, if you get the job done against Wales, I think Scotland is a way more viable option to do that.
But so the option is just to be relatively conservative, stick Chris Farrell in as a replacement.
He still did a good job, let's not forget, in November. He's a very, very solid player. He's got a better skill set than maybe we've seen so far internationally.
He's got better hands than he's given credit for.
Is he better than Carberry?
At that
he's
specific
totally
thing,
different.
Maybe not.
He's totally different. You're looking at at a different game plan.
That's it.
Playing with those two, with those guys.
And that game plan, that it's Joe's game plan, and it has been Joe's game plan. Get somebody who trucks it up, and maybe they might get a pass off. It's definitely not Joe's game plan to put the creative, fleet-footed 12 in there to see what happens.
No, it's a real team ethos of breaking sides down, rather than that real individuality where someone can do something like a Joey can. But we've had so much success. You look even against Italy, the amount of first phase near line breaks or line breaks that they made, or ankle tap once or twice. Keith Earls was going through, and yeah, Robbie went through on another one where Conor Murray then spilled it just under the posts off the next phase. So there were other, we're cutting teams apart. So you have to be a little bit careful as to what you wish for too, because it's going okay.
Yeah, it's going really well.
But
yeah,
we're cutting Italy apart.
Yeah, but listen, Wales sliced Scotland apart. The weather in Paris was absolutely horrible, so I think that is a big factor. Yes, I think we've got sterner tests, of course, coming, namely Wales next up. I think that'll be a real test as to where we are, because you know, France came at us with everything, and we scraped by with a magic moment. We put Italy to the sword. There are two, varying degrees of the scale. Whereas now, I think a real litmus test as to where this team is a revitalized Wales team, albeit coming off the back of a loss, and they can't afford another loss, otherwise there's no championship for them.
I know, it makes them so dangerous. It's like the England game, it almost felt like when they were kicking that penalty to make it a 6-point game, they were like, losing bonus point keeps us in the championship, as opposed to,
but they know. Well, they needed to give themselves a shot. They backed themselves as a team that can score from anywhere.
Yeah.
And that's why I thought there was a bit naive of them in the England game to try and play from their 22.
Yeah,
but you've got
with 3 minutes to go.
You've got two scores to get. Why are you kicking a penalty?
No, I would have gone for the penalty. I would have kicked that penalty to get to within a score.
I know, I understand that, but it gets you within one score. But you had this is the best chance you will have to get within 5 metres of the English line.
My issue was they get their 3 points, get to within a score, a converted score of winning, and they regain the ball back, and then they try and play sevens back in their own 22. You've got to do what Johnny did. You've got to go to kick contests. It's too far to work against a defence like England. You've got to play a little bit smarter, and I think that's where Anscombe just lost, maybe lacked a little bit of experience of knowing how you gain 40 metres without just running it, with holding on to possession. And they couldn't cough possession up, but possession, you make calculated risks as well.
Yeah.
Exactly what Johnny did with the Keith Earls crossfield kick. You've got to go, the odds were stacked against them to win that game, so go with a 60-40 bet to get yourself 40 metres gained up the pitch.
I'm amazed that you are, that's your way of thinking.
Because I'm thinking 3 points at that point, though.
I understand that, but you're far more likely to get, you're going to have to score a try no matter what happens. You're far more likely to get that try by kicking to the corner, as opposed to knowing you're beginning a try scoring drive from your own 22, where really, if you do manage to score the try for the second drive, all you need is a drop goal or to force a penalty.
Yeah, but
they really had no chance of winning the game once
you
they
have
the
to give your. That's it's the exact same philosophy as Ireland against France. You have to give yourself a shot. You've got to give yourself an outside bet. And if they kick to the corner and the line out maul doesn't happen and they don't get to within one score,
Game's over.
You've got to give yourself a chance. The odds are massively stacked against you, but it is dumb and dumber. You're saying there's a chance.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to still give yourself that outside chance of doing something.
All right, we've got to take a quick ad break. Stay tuned, because coming up, we're going to talk about some horrible officiating in the Six Nations so far.
The Six Nations on Off the Ball with Vodafone. Official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. We all belong to the team of us. The Six Nations on Off the Ball with Vodafone. Official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. We all belong to the team of us.
We got a little bit sidetracked there, but we ended up on the Wales-England game. So we may as well talk about this. This is the refereeing decision. And Stephen Ferris was on during the week, and he came up in conversation recently about the tip tackle that he was involved in. So here he is talking about both the Welsh decision and ultimately the decision that he was involved in a couple of years ago.
Wales are coming to the Aviva Stadium in a week and a half. You know, it wasn't that long ago where Wayne Barnes penalised me for a tip tackle at the end of the game. And a letter came back a week later after Lee Halfpenny slotted 3 points for them to win. And that was, I think that was the opening game, and they went on to win a Grand Slam. And the letter came apologising that more or less, you know, a referee decision had cost us the game because I had been proven innocent that it wasn't a tip tackle. So, like, referee decisions, it cannot get to the stage where they're deciding a championship. So I totally agree with Keith. That was a try. Would Wales have went on to win that match? I probably don't think they would have. Mm. However, at that time, they could have got a little bit of momentum, and hindsight's a wonderful, wonderful thing. But referee decisions, it needs to be looked at. Year in, year out, we keep talking about it, Joe. It keeps coming up on your show, keeps coming up on everything to do with rugby. And I just think it needs to be addressed and for it to be nailed down, because it's not good enough.
He obviously is you know, centrally involved in one of those incidents. You kind of brought it up unprompted a couple of weeks back as well. Like, it's weird that you have all of technology available to you and you still can't get these big decisions right.
It's very, very frustrating. I think that was, it's funny, that incident, I didn't see the game live, so I'd heard all the hoo-ha about it, and then I watched it a few hours later on. So for me, the referee, or the TMO in that decision, ultimately got the decision correct, because I do think that it was a knock-on off. Who was the winger?
So that it didn't come off his knee.
I think, but you couldn't see in the footage that was rolled out in that period of time. You couldn't see that happened. That only came to light in social media with massively zoomed in cameras, where it was the slightest graze off his finger. But it is a knock on. So I think he got the decision wrong.
Not the reason that he ruled the try out.
He got the decision wrong on the basis of the try was perfectly good. That looked as though it came off his knee. The try looked perfectly good. Well, it was, because Anscombe got downward pressure. Just, it's not even downward pressure. Your hand just has to make contact with the ball, which makes contact with the ground. It doesn't even have to be a force. Making any level of contact with it is good enough. And
so where does the control aspect come in? Keeps coming up, but I don't think that's part of the rule.
I think there's a big onus on referees there too. I think that's where you look at the best referees in the world take ownership of that. I think it's a bit of a cop-out that certain referees just throw it to the TMO and go, right, you make the decision. You're the referee, you're in charge of it. Ultimately, the final decision lands on you. So be the dominant factor in this. And that's where Nigel Owens steps up to the plate time and time again. He uses his TMO as a helping hand rather than the option provider or the decision maker. So he goes, this is what I see. Yeah, it is. It's like, okay, here's what I'm seeing. Provided there's good screens. So he goes and looks at the incident. He goes, okay, this is what I think happens. Correct me if I'm wrong. And that jargon is, correct me if I'm wrong if you really disagree with me. If you think that you're happy enough, or you know, you're not entirely sure, just go with me on that.
Yeah.
So he goes, I'm going to make the decision, bang. And away he goes. Other referee throwing it to the TMO. It's inexcusable for a TMO to get that decision wrong. Inexcusable. But then, you know, I think it was Alain Roland, the head of the referees, went and rang Rob Howley or Warren Gatland, to apologise for it. I think that's crazy too. So you have to protect your referees too, or your TMOs, and not throw them all collectively under the bus. I think there's mixed messaging coming from World Cup. That letter to Fez is crazy. What, like, sorry about that. What purpose does that serve? Actually delivering that letter, other than just to frustrate Ireland and feel hard done by.
Yeah.
So decisions are going to be incorrect, but you've got to make the right decisions and the wrong decisions as an organisation. I don't think World Rugby do that.
I think they can hold their hands up and say they're wrong, but not like on a one-to-one basis.
Yeah, don't go, oh, he was wrong. Yeah. Just go, yes, we were wrong. Yeah. We, as a collective.
Because it's
we got it wrong. Yeah, a referee, yeah. We got it wrong. Don't isolate individuals on it.
But the TMO has less wriggle room when it comes to accountability. He is in possession of all of the angles, of all the film, all of the facts. Like, a referee can make a decision. If he gets it wrong, there's a little less culpability on him. But everybody was watching this, and the second he could disallow the try, we all just went, you've got that wrong.
But it's not just him, and I don't know, the screen might be fantastic in Twickenham, and there was a bit of difficulty with Garces not being able to hear him properly, a guy talking to an English speaker, but he's able to see the screen too. We were all watching it, and we saw that he got there was contact made first from Anscombe, so he's got to overrule the TMO. He knows the rules. He's a referee. He knows exactly what necessitates a 22 dropout or a Wales try. And it looks like no one can disagree that Anscombe got his hand on
the... We're watching it at home, though, on our HD TV screens. I don't think Garces is watching it. I don't think Garces is watching it with the same...
No, but the TMO is.
Pixelation. The TMO is, yes. But so in terms of asking Garces to be the big man and doing a Nigel Owens on it and saying, well, do you know what, this is what I'm seeing because I've seen it here. From my own recollection, now I could be wrong, but I've been to Twickenham a handful of times, that I don't think the quality of the screen in Twickenham is as good as it is elsewhere, so that Garces could see very obviously that that should have been awarded.
Maybe it's something.
Maybe there needs to be uniformity of screens in the stadiums,
but you can,
so that every referee is in the same position.
He's within his right to say, I can't see, explain it to me in certain circumstances. But mostly it should be, this is, I've made my decision, am I right or wrong? Like, have you got compelling evidence to overturn my decision? You know, that would have been, that's the way.
Yeah, the way it should be done.
Yeah, and the referee has the ultimate arbiter of that. Like, England getting a big decision at home to win a really close game. I don't actually agree with Stephen. I think that Wales would have gone on to win that game.
I do agree with Fez. Yeah, I do. I think England had too much for them. I think Wales were very lucky to be 12-3 down. Was it 12-3 at half? No, 12-0.
It was 12-3 when they kicked that goal at, like, with 10 minutes left to go, or 5 minutes.
I think it was 12-0 at half time.
Did they score two tries? I think there might have been a Welsh penalty in between the two tries.
I thought they were very lucky, Wales, on the first half.
I think there was a kick between the two Johnny May tries.
Yeah, I thought they were pretty fortunate. In fairness to them, I was looking at all the stats, and you were kind of wondering, when you look at the game, particularly that first half, and then you look at the scoreline, and you think, how did Wales manage to stay in that? But all the stats were massively in their favour too. They made more, made a higher percentage of their tackles, 50% of possession and territory. Their line out and scrum efficiency was very good, I think both near 100%. So Wales didn't do a whole lot wrong and still gave themselves an outside shot against the second best team in the world. Yeah. So,
yeah, and that's played some really good rugby in the last quarter. Yeah. Could have scored that try if they just maybe executed the dive a bit better. Or
when I saw Scott Williams make that dive, I thought that's brilliant. I thought, but it was a phenomenal tackle as well.
It was
really brilliant tackle.
I think he overestimated the slickness of the surface, though.
Maybe if you were to have that moment back, I think the only alternative that he could have done was dived slightly more infield on the dive to try and. And this is, here we are pulling it apart a week later, you know, it's a hundredth of a second decision, but to allow for that force to have to be greater to carry him over the sideline, to get more distance from the sideline. But
even to use the
momentum. I thought it was a clever dive, and he wasn't going to get in if he tried to dive on the line. He had to go early.
You talked about England's line speed being a little bit better than, or faster than ours. How is that? Like, why don't we key off as quickly as them? What is the difference?
They're sprinting out of the blocks. They are sprinting. They are a little bit vulnerable on the extremities, I think, as well, a small bit, particularly on Johnny May's wing, because I think he's at times at sixes and sevens, knowing where he's meant to be. And his attacking game is so prolific at the moment that I think that's getting him in the team. He's a real weapon, and, you know, going forward, I think he is a bit vulnerable in defence. I think Joseph going in there and his acceleration off the line, he's a good defender. He's not going to monster anyone, but he makes a lot of good decisions, makes a lot of solid tackles. There, lots of sides are really aggressive from in the first five defenders from the ruck.
Yeah.
But their aggressiveness almost appears to start three out from the ruck and continue right across the line. And
so it's attitude as opposed to a combination of attitude and athleticism.
Yeah, I think so. I think they've targeted it.
Are we targeting it too?
We're not doing it to the same degree.
On purpose?
We're not. Yeah, it's not part of our system. Okay. I think Paul Gustard has evolved that English defence to another level, which makes him very, very difficult to get to the outside. If you're brave enough and if you're willing to get the quality of pass and hold your depth enough to get it out there, I think there are, you know, you can exploit them because
so like a long their scramble skip isn't,
yeah, because of that line speed, they don't have as much of a fallback on their scramble.
Yeah.
So can I ask you then,
upfield.
Can you keep them honest in the first few minutes by utilising a Carlos Spencer, Mark Ring type knee on the ball? So that if they're absolutely ripping up out of the line in your face, the first receiver or the second receiver just drops it on his knee and just pops it over the head.
Mm.
Particularly if Anthony Watson is holding his position at fullback, or Mike Brown is holding his position at fullback, and there might be a 30 metre slot in which to drop the ball, you just keep them guessing in the first 10 minutes.
Yeah, I think there's another way of doing it as well. I think particularly with our loop plays that they're going to know that we do, I think you have to be careful on the loop plays against them. They'll read through the line and hammer you, but I think there's an option of a loop play to a kick pass. So Johnny to whoever the first ball carries, a Bundy or whoever else, and get it back, pull the winger up. I don't think Mike Brown closes the gate very quickly. I think he's to cover the backfield. He's relying on that front line to make all the tackles, and he's just last ditch effort. So I think pull Johnny May forward by showing as though you're doing a loop play and maybe a backs play, and then go to the kick pass. I think that's an absolutely a viable option come England game. But we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves with that. We still have two others before that.
Yeah.
Just so why don't we, as a matter of interest, what is different from our defensive system that we decide that actually it's a little bit, it's not passive on the outside, but it's different from the Gustard style. Why does the Irish defensive system think they look at what England go, yeah, okay, I see what you're doing, but no, we like ours better?
I don't know. It's a good question. I think Paul Gustard, it's an evolution of what was in place. I think we're still seeing Farrell coming in and you know, building our new system.
I don't think we're there like that.
No one.
They're unique in their lines.
Yeah, they are. On that level of aggressiveness on the outside, I don't think there's anyone in the world. Certainly not any Southern Hemisphere teams. All the Southern Hemisphere teams are soft.
To what he has available to him. He sees what the athleticism that his
Yeah, but like you look at listen, Gary Ringrose is absolutely perfect.
So we could do it.
We totally could do it. I think we need to still increase our line speed on the outside. I think we're fast, like I said, from the first five defenders, but we get a little bit softer then. I think we can be brave and leave a couple of men over at times and try and slam the gate. You are a bit susceptible to that kick pass, but you're not going to be able to cover everything.
Yeah, that's
so,
the point.
So if you put massive pressure on the 10, on Ford or Farrell or whoever's first receiver to not have time to execute that kick pass, I think, you know, there's a good way of trying to suppress that.
Yeah. I've been boring everybody about the fact that the Welsh were initially 12-point underdogs and 4-1 for the game in Dublin, which I think is a 3-point game that could go either way, which is kind of 50-50, slightly Ireland's
favourite. They're still 12 now, are
they? It's 10 now, and it's
down still
to,
a good bet.
And it's down to their 10-3 to win the game. I still
don't
think
know
it's
10
how
points.
It's 10. Like, look at the injuries we have, and look at the Faletau is probably going to be back. Liam Williams is going to be
back when he's back.
North played quite well in patches when he came off. Okay, still looked a bit brainless at times. Halfling's back. And there's a couple more. Players. You're like, they're getting players back, and we're like, well, Shawnee O'Brien definitely not going to happen now. Ringer's obviously not going to happen now. So Furlong will play. But is Jack Conan fit? I'm not sure. Why did he come off?
Jack Conan's not going to start anyway. You know, you're
he's
you're,
going with the same back three.
He's with CJ and Pete and Dan Levy. I think that's your back row again until Sean comes back.
And who's in the second row now? I don't know.
It's Henderson and who?
Tracy.
Ryan.
Henderson and Ryan.
Ryan, sorry. Like I don't know how much Ryan was being minded in the build up to the Italian game, but geez, he did nothing wrong in Paris.
Yeah, I think Ryan is ultimately the one of the starting second rows in the World Cup. So yeah, you've got to get him in the team more. I wonder, is he minding him a bit? We talked before about that, that he's in his early years, he's a bit susceptible to picking up knocks, you know, dead legs, and he'll have to learn to carry them a little bit more. Yeah. So whether Joe's minding him a small bit and not, you know, playing him in consecutive games, whether now he's got a game and then, you know, 2 weeks before the next one, so an opportunity to ease him into this international setup. Yeah. But Devon didn't have a poor game. He's guaranteed line out ball.
Yeah.
I think Toner was always going to start against the Italians. Okay. That was always going to be the pre-plan, that once he'd made the call with Ryan for Paris, that Toner was always going to play. The problem is, when you're playing against Italy, you have to do something outrageous to convince the coach that what you've done is good enough, that it supersedes a big performance from Ryan at the Stade de France. And it's so hard for any player to do that. I think Ryan is being prepped for Wales.
Yeah, I think he probably is too. Because he just has a bit and has more athleticism, because you'd be hopeful that our line out will still work well enough without Devon calling it.
Yeah, except that Alan Wynne-Jones is brilliant at that stuff. Like, that's his...
Yeah.
Although maybe that's the exact thing you have to learn.
You have to back yourself. And we were flawless from the line outs in against the French. So
you could see Devon playing against England, because they've got three second rows playing in their team, you know, with those three options.
Yeah.
You just need someone taller to throw it. You know, particularly they're good. Cruz runs a good up. He's on the bench, but you know, Itoje and Launchbury's been very good for them.
Yeah.
Might we do that? Might we move Henderson back?
No,
play Ryan and Toner together.
No, because Peter Mahoney not going to start. Not a chance. No, you need.
That'd be our best line-out option. Defensively and
but you don't pick. I don't think you pick the rest of your game or on the basis of whether you're good defensively and offensively in your line out. I think it's one aspect.
I'm arguing against myself for O'Mahony not playing because
against
the French, he was just superb.
But like, if you look at Peter as well, if you want to guarantee, you know, close a game down with 1 minute to go and you're up, he's your go to at two. It's a fast ball at two. Mm. There's no one's going to beat him. Get off the ground quicker than him. If your hooker throws it to the right spot, no one's beating Pete from a counter movement perspective.
And if you need to steal one,
if the opposition want to throw that fast ball at two, get him in there in front, because again, his ability, his reaction time is exceptional.
So otherwise, the team is exactly the same with Farrell in at 12 or 13, whatever.
Yeah, 13, obviously. I think he plays a lot of 13 for Munster, but Scannell at 12. They mix and match it too, and I'm sure Ireland will do that likewise. They'll share the workload with Bundy and himself to carry ball. They're both reasonably good. They're both good passers of the ball.
Yeah.
That's not take away. It's not battering ram stuff, but that is the game plan. They do think Ireland do look for advantage line.
Yeah.
You know, that's what you have to do internationally. It's a tough physical game. It's not easy. You don't get soft advantage lines anymore. So that's why, you know, having big players being able to truck it up for you is advantageous.
So that's going to be the scenario there. In the build up to this game, there's going to be a lot made of Sean O'Brien's comments about the Lions and Warren Gatland coming back. And Gatland's mind games from his perspective so far have been, we're going to win this thing, you know. And after the Scotland game, he was like, I said all week in training we were going to batter them, and we did. And then, I don't know, maybe he had to eat crow a little bit after the Eddie Jones team actually beats them and controls that game. But he has in the past said that CJ Sanders is really easy to defend against. Now, then he obviously had to coach him in the Lions and did end up picking him for a game. Does any of that stuff matter?
He's right and he's wrong with the CJ standard thing. I think CJ needs to evolve his game a little bit. I think he needs to learn to become a player that can tip on, that isn't just direct physical and nutritional. Late footwork on the line a little bit more, make things a little bit easier for him from a durability point of view as well. If you're running, if you're making holes, it's going to take a toll on your body too. So
I don't see that footwork on the line from Stander.
No, that ever coming.
Not that it's ever coming.
He backs himself. His advantage line is just to carry.
And so why like, you know, he's been around a while now. Why hasn't that been developed?
I don't know. I think you look, do you know why you look at players like Billy Vunipola, who's come on leaps and bounds on the basis of that. Everyone knows how good a ball carrier is, but when you've got nice soft hands and you run, you know, decoy lines as aggressively as whether you're getting the ball, like, that sits defenders down. I think that's the next evolution to be a really top class, world class number eight. CJ's a very, very good standard number eight, but I think just he needs to have a little bit more variety to his game to make him less readable, because good sides like Wales, good chop tacklers,
yeah, well, that's what,
you know,
we'll
be able to, we'll put him down and stop him getting an advantage line.
Yeah, so we don't need to worry about that though too much now that, like, now that he's told us that's what he's going to do with that. Like, you'd hope that.
Well, you look at CJ's opportunity too. That, well, they still have to do it.
Yeah.
Does he run it a little bit harder? Does he, you know, raise his game a little bit more? Put some more focus into how he's going to get his advantage line. So it works both ways. Yeah. Not just Gats's chat.
So it's not just negative then, like, because a lot of the mind game seems to be a bit of bollocks. And then you kind of think about Eddie Jones picking out a young out half, and it's like, well, maybe he's just telling the truth. Maybe that young out half will be nervous, and maybe he's just reminding.
They rattled him. They rattled him. They did. They went after him, and whether Reece Patchell looks like a strong enough personality, he didn't have his greatest game, but there's no doubt that so, it had an effect of sorts.
Do you, like, all he said was he's not going to he's away from home against in front of 80,000 at Twickenham. He's not going to have the same easy ride as he got against the Scots, and he also said that he was inexperienced at test level.
But he said with Eddie Jones' actions and his statements. Eyes and his meaning and his, like, track records.
It was the England players that rattled Patchell, not Jones' comments, in my opinion. They absolutely got up into the face of a young 10, which you'd absolutely expect.
Who already had a little voice in his head going,
I don't know.
Like, it's not that's it. That's why they do it.
It wasn't people said that he'd stepped over the line and it was getting personal.
Well, I don't know if he stepped over the line
bullshit.
Or not.
I disagree with that. I think, yeah, it's not.
Regardless of that,
I think what was stepping over the line was the Johnny Sexton talk chat 2 years ago, where he said, if I was his parents, I'd be concerned. That's stepping over the line. Whereas talking about a player, if he's not going to have an armchair ride of it like he did last weekend, and he's young and inexperienced, that's just actually telling the truth.
Exactly. So, I've no problem with that.
Yeah,
it's not about having a problem. It's whether or not it works. Like, so, like, you're saying,
I think Jonathan Joseph and Chris Robshaw, and that's why it worked.
I mean, you can't deny that. Obviously, that's why it works. But, like, maybe in his head, I don't know.
It's also messaging for his own team. Whatever about the messaging for Patchell, it's telling Robshaw, I want you to hunt him down. I want Joseph. You know, you're on the bench last week. You're getting a start. I want you to make a nightmare of it. 100% too. There's messages for everyone that wants to pick it up.
Yeah.
And us too, to debate it. You know, there's a little something for everyone there. He's a generous guy, Eddie.
It's a theatre from it. Yeah. So look, all this is going on against the backdrop of the Pro 14 games. And I don't think you probably ever played any Pro 14 game ever during the Six Nations. But it must be a real pain.
Maybe if it was come back for injury. Yeah. But yeah, no, thankfully we were so well looked after. Yeah. And
it must be a pain in the hole for the players playing. It's like,
The players that are playing are the ones that are trying to play their way into contention. You know, Sean Cronin needs game time. That's the thing. When you're on the bench too, there's nothing worse than finding yourself on the bench. So someone like John Ryan, for instance, got very little game time in November, and then all of a sudden back at Munster found himself second choice behind Stephen Archer.
Yeah.
So you lose fitness, you're not getting any game time, you're not having an opportunity to build your confidence, and then you go back to the team that another guy has been able to impress in your absence, and he's gone really well. So sometimes that, you know, that 16 to 23 spot, or even 24, 25 is even worse, because you're not even getting to be part of the squad. You do lose a bit of momentum in your season.
Well, I'm just looking to get confirmation. Jordan Larmour is playing 15, which is obviously unbelievably exciting. But if you're Joey Carber, you're like, okay, so Leinster think Ross Byrne is the second choice number 10. And now Larmour keeps ripping up trees every time he plays 15, and Carney's probably their first choice. Where the hell am I going to get a game?
He's in a terrible spot. That injury really has.
I don't know why aren't they? If we're all the talk of Joey, you know, playing 12, why isn't he playing 12 this weekend instead of Noel Reid? With respect, Noel Reid's fine, grand player. But he hasn't set the world alight for a number of seasons now.
And in a Leinster team that has a midfield issue now that Robbie Henshaw's gone.
And he's not going to. Noel Reid's not going to monster anyone in defence. So you're not
back to Leinster. So Leinster couldn't have picked him.
But no, I'm wondering if Joe really wants him to get game time or genuinely believes that he's a viable option. I don't know whether what the relationship is like with Leo and Stuart Lancaster to be able to ask those favours. I suppose you have to give one to get one. But he should be doing that if he sees it as an option going forward.
Yeah, it's a pity he isn't. One last thing. England have the Georgians in this week to scrum against them, and we haven't really seen this too often in the middle of the Six Nations, where, you know, you get your international team, you send them out, you try and get them to... the RFU winning friends and influencing people for future World Cup things, or is it like...
Well, George doesn't know how to scrummage too, you know. You get maybe a bit of that, maybe keeping everyone on side, being looking to be the good guy, raising the profile of one of the sides that's trying to get into Six Nations, and also getting a decent training session out of it. There's phenomenal stat that there's something like 36 Georgian front rows in the top two divisions in France in the Pro D2, yeah, something like that.
There's
actually, there's an assembly line of Georgian rows in being built as we speak back in Georgia.
There was like an opposite of the sevens game where you just play with scrums, they'd be like world champions.
So, they know what they're at there. They're big, powerful beasts. So, they would have gotten I'm sure they got a good head out. And what's your alternative against one another? Or you get you get a bit more...
A few corporate gigs.
You get a little bit more spice to it when... You know, these Georgians would come along and want to impress against...
Get a contract with somebody else. On that point, should Georgia be in the Six Nations instead of Italy? I mean,
they should be in the conversation, that's for sure.
Should there be a playoff?
Yeah, I think, but again, we're coming back to that playoff situation where on the year where one team has a disaster and they finish last, and everyone other than England have done that in the last 8-10 years. France finished last a few seasons ago.
Then you just win your playoff.
Yeah, but it's a risk. Financially, that is, it's unthinkable that the IRFU would be in free fall off the back of not having a Six Nations.
Yeah.
You would disband immediately. that's not...
Take the seats
from
the
Aviva. Be careful what you wish for.
But you could probably protect that, couldn't you? Like, there'd be some kind of parachute payment the way they have in the Premier League. Like, if they wanted to, they could fix this, but they don't really want to.
Who really wants to? Exactly. Who really wants it?
Let's have the Georgians in.
The Georgians want it. For the Italians,
you can only sub in for the Italians, but any other year, anybody else finishes, like, no.
Yeah.
Not having
that.
Maybe if you finish bottom 2 years in a row, then you're forced into a playoff.
I think that's a better option.
So you've got a long time to get your house in order.
So the Georgians are like cheering, you know, for everyone against Italy.
Plus, having to head to Tbilisi, no disrespect to any of our Georgian viewers or listeners, you know, you'd much rather spend a weekend every 2 years in
Rome. We would. It's great. It's a brilliant weekend. We love it. That's why we're keeping the Italians in. I mean, come on. It's like those Blazers, they know how to have a good time, and actually, so do we. On that note, Brian, great stuff. Thanks very much.
Cheers.
The Six Nations on Off the Ball with Vodafone. Official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. We all belong to the team of us.